I do have some slides to show. There are some ecumenical issues between the Mac and PC environments here, and not all of my images have crossed over. So you'll see a blank slide every once in a while, and that's fine. That'll work just as well. A couple things, I don't know, caveats, if you want to call them, maybe to bracket what I'm hoping to accomplish in this short session here. One is, when I started thinking about theology in the built environment, a lot of questions were popping into my head, and a lot of stuff was out there, sort of secular work that was unpacking this stuff. And there wasn't, as Tim has mentioned, there isn't a lot of theological literature to lean on. And so I started talking about it with everybody. And after a while, my friends stopped listening to me. And so they, the way we tell it in our families, they sent me to my basement to start writing, maybe to widen my audience a little bit, give them a break. So I did start writing, and I really sort of wrote as sort of an amateur theologian in a way, and from the hip. And that's I stand behind most of what I wrote. I only say it as a way of putting myself in context with what Tim's doing. I came across Tim's book about 2 weeks after I submitted my manuscript, my final version. And in a way, I'm very grateful that I ran into it at that timing instead of 2 weeks before that, because I'm not sure if I would have finished the project, because Tim had what I was looking for in that early stage. So I'm deeply appreciative of what Tim is bringing to this conversation and the deep theological wells he is drawing from. And I hope to eventually get to a point where I've got a really solid theology informing these instincts that I had as a pastor in Missoula. The second thing I want to say is that the conversation we've just had and what Heidi has been telling us about, I really understand that's more directly kingdom work in some ways than what I'm doing. I feel like I'm doing what I'm called to do, and that's all we can do, but it feels to me a little bit indirect. I think it's very legitimate, but it's indirect, and I know I'm vulnerable in some ways to, okay, how is this helping the poor right now? So if you want to ask that question, feel free. But I'm just saying I understand that there's an indirectness to what I'm doing. I want the church to be asking questions cognizant of the built environment. And secondly, I do think changing the structures ultimately will have a more direct kingdom outlay. But you know, we're called to do one piece along this way. So having said that, we can get on to our first slide. It's a piece of pizza. It's a whole pizza. And I just want to tell you that on Friday nights at our house, we let our kids watch a movie, and we make pizza, and we eat pizza in front of the movie theater, in front of the screen. And everybody gets to make their own pizza. And, you know, as houses being what they are and families being what they are, what that means is we pull out whatever we have in the refrigerator and get some dough going, and it becomes a pizza. But we're very creative about the kind of ingredients we put into a pizza. And everybody has different things they will do and won't do, and we're trying new things. But I've come to realize through that tradition that you can get away with a lot of very bizarre things in terms of a coherent pizza with a little bit of creativity. I say that by way of introduction because pizza is the image that Leon Krier uses to describe a city. Because a pizza is made up of a set of ingredients. And it doesn't have to be the same set of ingredients, but it's made up of a set of ingredients. And together, those ingredients make the pizza. Now, if that's what a city is, a neighborhood is a slice of pizza. So you slice the pizza, and you get a neighborhood. It's not the whole pizza, but everything you love about the pizza is included in the slice of pizza. It's a very simple concept, and if you violate it, my kids will instantly, even, you know, Emma at 4 will instantly rebel against that simple violation of the principle of pizza. So, let's see, how shall I, I think my slides are a bit out of order. Go to the next one. Let's stay on the pizza for a second. You can hit the back button. what we've done in America in the post-war era is we have decided that this pizza business is too messy, and this neighborhood business is too messy as well. So we've decided that a city serves a variety of functions, has a variety of ingredients, and instead of letting neighborhoods each do everything that a city does well, we've decided to rationally divide out the purposes of the city into various zones. And so the equivalent in the pizza world would be, instead of serving a pizza on Friday night, you serve a lump of dough, a stack of cheese, a stack of pepperoni, and sauce. And you consume them one at a time because it's more rational, it's more efficient. And like I said, Emma would be the first, well, she wouldn't be the first, but she would definitely protest against that way of being served pizza because it doesn't make any sense. But that's precisely what we've done in post-war America. We have taken all the aspects of the city, the living, the shopping, the industry, the worshiping, the playing, and separated them out into separate zones and said, well, it's more efficient, and that's how it's going to work. So if you turn to the second slide, you should have a picture of a zoning map. And zoning is, it has a little bit of a complicated history, but basically, it became the dominant way of all new construction following World War II in America. This notion that we were going to divide up land according to use. And it would that meant that if it was a residential area, you couldn't have anything commercial in that area. And it was a very odd decision, and it had a lot of reasons for why we would do that. See if I can, go to the next slide, and if you can see that, you can see Cryer's little pizza analogy being imaged for you. We decided that it would be more rational. It made sense with the amount of resources that we had. It made sense with our sort of instinctual desire of running away from problems instead of solving them. All this made sense in terms of zoning. Well, we divided up space, but the effect was, and you won't get this next image, but you can turn to the next one so you get it. The effect of all this is this zoning thing that we've done since World War II has led to a deeply unsatisfying way of life, where we're in our cars a lot more than we want to. We don't have as much informal interaction at the neighborhood level, and it's extremely dissatisfying and wasteful in a lot of ways. I'm going to talk about the alternative way of thinking about space besides zoning and suburbia. Before I do, though, let me then insert this as a footnote to some of what Tim's been talking about. I want to propose, I think Tim's right that the impulse for suburbia may have its origins in the 1800s with Raymond Unwin and some of the other bucolic sort of planners and things like that. And there's a lot of that kind of early history of suburbia that we can think about. But I really think something distinct happened with post-war suburbia and this notion of zoning and this notion of making all allowances for the automobile. The reason I say that is there's a lot of different ways you could define suburbia, and they would all maybe have a certain coherence. But this particular notion of zoning use is one that can be applied in any kind of density. You can, in Pasadena, it's sort of an urban environment, but we have a suburban building right in the middle of Pasadena. You know, it's got the suburban logic, it's got the suburban DNA right there. And you can be in sort of a place that's a little bit out of a major metropolitan area that really has a nice town kind of feel because it doesn't have that suburban DNA built into it. So you can think of suburbia as away from a metropolitan area, a certain level of density, a certain sort of historical time when it was originated, or you can think of suburbia as this DNA of zoning and functional use. And I want us to think about suburbia in that second way, because I think that brings out some more helpful things for our discussion. So, the other thing about suburbia, it can be hard to define. But oftentimes it's invisible. It's invisible to, you won't get an image on this one too. It's invisible to us, and I'll just give you one example. I mean, on the one hand, everything can be defined as suburbia, unless it's like central downtown core. But on the other hand, it's invisible. You look at, you take the issue of urbanization, which we're all sort of familiar with, this notion that, you know, over the past 100 years or more, there's been a general decline in rural living. So there's one, if you look up urbanization graphs, there's a general decline in rural living and a gradual or steep incline in urban living. That's sort of the narrative that we've all heard. Well, where does the suburbs fit into that? At least in this country, yeah, there's been a decline in rural living, but I wouldn't say there's been an increase in urban living. Everybody's living in the suburbs. And so there's a real, in that conversation, we're not thinking about the suburban model as in any way distinct from the urban model of living. So I'm proposing that we think about cities as different from the suburbs and also maybe different from rural. So in fact, I'm gonna make a change here. Instead of calling these markers of the city, the word that might be most helpful is say markers of urbanity, in the sense that we can have urbanism at a variety of density and a variety of scales. So here are what I'm gonna call six markers of the city with, as a deliberate attempt to distinguish them from the suburbs. All right, the first marker of the city is, or of urbanity, is that it's mixed in use. I'll start here with the opposite to bring that to light. In the suburbs, everything is separated. And so we separate out all the different uses, as I've been talking about. That started with an impulse to separate commercial from residential. Okay, there was a landmark Supreme case, Euclid versus Ambler Realty, 1936. It was in a suburb of Cleveland, and the Supreme Court decided that it's legal to say this area can be only used for residential and cannot be used for commercial. Now, if you read that document, it's very interesting to see the kind of cultural assumptions that are built into that. One of them is commercial is not good for children. And I'm not sure, you know, they're thinking smoky factories, industrial revolution, and danger for children, but what about a coffee shop? What about a bike repair shop? What about a barber shop? Is that kind of commercial bad for children? Not so clear. They're working on a sort of Victorian notion of family is a place where you're protected from society, not a place where the community is part of the process of raising children. They don't want commercial in the residential area because they don't want strangers loitering. If there's a commercial place, strangers might loiter. Well, that's an odd one because it has sort of a static view of strangers in the sense that maybe if the stranger loiters every couple of days at 3 o'clock, you might get to know this person and no longer a stranger. I mean, or maybe because you have no place to loiter and hang out, neighbors have no common place to go, so your next door neighbor becomes a stranger. I mean, it's a flexible notion, this notion of strange. It's not this fixed category of stranger. So that's very strange. The other one that I think is probably the most true to its intent is the scale is so large that they just want to say commercial can't be in residential. And they even admit that. There may be some good commercial and there may be some bad commercial, but at the level at which we're looking at things, it's impossible for us to make the distinction. It's extremely important when talking about the city or urbanism or the built environment to think about from which angle you're looking. A planner looks from the bird's eye view. They look at these blobs of zone. It looks very pretty. It looks very organized. Even some of the plans, you know, like the Garden Cities of Tomorrow, it looks pretty, it looks geometric, it looks pleasing from that level, but the scale is so high you can't tell the difference between a 7-Eleven and a really funky little coffee shop. They look the same at that level. So that's one bizarre way to look at the scale. While we're on the subject of perspective, the other ways you could look at a city, one is the idealized view, the postcard view, where you're up at this angle and you're looking down and everything, it looks just perfect. And a lot of times, you know, when buildings are proposed and are shown to the public, they're at that angle. They draw in the pedestrians, and it always looks pretty at that angle. And a lot of the funding happens there. The other angle, the one that we're probably most used to seeing cities, is at the as at the freeway scale or the arterial scale, where you're inside a car and you're traveling 35 to 55 miles an hour. And that's a very distinct way the city gets shaped. That's why we have the lollipop signs with the huge thing saying, you know, tires or whatever. Those aren't meant for pedestrians to see, but for cars to see that are traveling rather fast. There's certain kind of detail you can't make out at that speed. So anyway, they start to separate out residential from commercial. So the next slide is a commercial establishment. That happens to be a retail establishment. The other thing is, I think bureaucracies, once they get something like this going, like we need zoning because it, you know, it makes rational sense, they'll start making it more complicated so that they can justify their job as people who write the zoning codes and people who enforce the zoning codes. And so they'll start to make it even more complicated. It's not just commercial and residential. Now they're separating retail. And turn to the next slide. From industrial. So that is a separate zone now. Even though manufacturing has changed quite a bit since the Industrial Revolution, and you have industry that you wouldn't mind having nearby. Did you get a picture of an office building there?
Well, I have a Mac, so I can see every. But are we already the one that says markers of the city, mixed use?
Yeah, you're there.
All right.
What slide are you looking at?
There's a bunch of houses, and then there's.
Keep going.
Okay.
You guys are tracking.
All right.
The other thing that we did is we started to separate out housing by income level. Now, this is sort of tricky. It wasn't exactly zoned in, but it did work well with the developers in the sense that you could zone low density residential, which meant houses needed to be built on 5 acres or something like that. And so we now separate large houses from small houses or medium-sized houses, or, you know, $500,000 houses from $450,000 houses, extreme fine levels of income gradation for whole neighborhoods. So, you know, one of the characteristics of American culture today is oftentimes you have nothing in common with your neighbor except the price of your house. You know, you live in these very fine gradations of income separation, and we have to separate all the houses that are even small houses from the attached houses, like condominiums or apartment buildings. Now, you might be thinking of it, exceptions to this rule, even in things that have been newly built. But that has changed maybe in the last 5 years. That did not used to be the case. So that's the principle of separation that we have in the suburbs. One of the problems, go to the next slide, with the freeway tangle. One of the problems is when you separate all the uses, you guarantee that everybody has to drive to do everything. Now, when we think about driving and the issues of commuting, we may still be thinking about, oh, how far is my commute to work? But maybe we're not keeping in mind that the number of trips we're taking per day has dramatically increased. We're not only driving to work, we're driving to buy aspirin. We're driving to get a cup of coffee. We're driving to see our friend. We're driving to go to school. We're driving to go play soccer, because they've combined all the parks into a park or to a soccer zone. Okay, so that's separation. Mixed use, by contrast, turn to the next page, we'll have a lot of those uses happening in the same area. I think you get a picture of this this cafe on the street. Okay, cafe on the street, pretty simple thing going on there, but right there you've got at least three uses happening. You've got residential above the stores, you've got retail going on the store, and you've got a restaurant serving food on the street. That kind of mixed use adds a kind of interest level. If you can imagine some single family detached houses across the street or just down the block, then you've got income mixed use. You've got people with less money living in apartments above the stores. You've got people with more money living in detached houses. And you get things happening like teachers who teach in that neighborhood able to live in that neighborhood. So a little bit more interaction. You get, in Pasadena, it's a huge issue. All the gardeners and all the maids that work in Pasadena have to travel for, you know, at least an hour, if not more, to come in and do that. Their quality of life goes down. So the mixed use, in the way I'm using it, is mixed use in terms of not only residential and commercial and retail and worship, but it's also mixed in income use as well. And that makes a big difference, I think, in the vibrancy of the community. All right. The next marker is the marker of public space. The suburbs are all about private space. If you drive into a suburban subdivision, and this is where you'll really see the difference between Raymond Unwin's one, especially the ones that were built before the automobile domination, is you drive into a suburban subdivision and you're likely to see a sea of garage doors. And what you see are houses that have turned their backs on the public square. They're oriented backwards towards the backyard. It's just a sea of garage doors. And it's very alienating to walk in that kind of environment. I've been lost in the suburbs, well, many times, and there's rarely anybody to ask for directions because nobody's out there. It's very confusing. And a person can arrange their life in that kind of environment to never enter the public realm. They enter their car in their garage from their mudroom or whatever they've got there, get into a car, which is essentially kind of a little protection from any, you know, possibility of hitting public space, and they drive along street corridors, park underground in their office building, take an elevator up, and the entire day is spent in the private realm. Very different way to experience the public than prior to suburbia. Whereas in a traditional city or a traditional neighborhood, public space is given a priority. And so you do have opportunities to interact with people in the public realm. Now, it's very important when we talk about public space that we avoid abstractions. In America, we sort of, I don't know, when we do take action, sometimes it gets derailed by its abstractions. And so you hear a lot about open space laws. We need open space. You know, we had one of these authors come to Missoula, and all the environmentalists were saying, we need more open space. And he looked around and said, you've got too much open space. You know, there's no activity. It's not being channeled anywhere. And so public space can be shaped in a certain way. And I think what you need to say instead of, developers, you know, they need to do a project and they need to make 10% open space. And so they'll take the best real estate and place all the houses and figure out the views and do all this stuff. And they'll find some odd lot that's undevelopable and call it open space. And it's completely non-functional, you know, for the community. Whereas if you say, you need to include a square or a plaza, and here's what a square or a plaza looks like. You know, it may still be 10% open space, but it's much more functional. If you're walking along the road or walking along a sidewalk and you see a juniper berm, you know, by an office building, that's their open space, you know, just this empty sort of, you know, symbolic statement of open space. So anyway, public space is part of what we have in the urban scene. Now, this next slide you may not be able to see very well, but it should be up there. It's a picture of Leon Krier, one of his pictures, and this gets us into public space. Not only is more available in more traditional urban and neighborhood environments, but oftentimes it's given spatial priority. And so if you see at the top, there's all the public space and public buildings are sort of first thought out in the city, and they're lined up in a way that gives some coherence to the people walking around. And then all the commercial and residential things are allowed to fill in around the edge. That's the opposite of the way we do it in suburbia, where first all the commercial interests buy up the good stuff, and what's left over becomes public buildings, public space. So you may not be able to see it very well, but that's what it is. All right. One of my favorite kinds of public space isn't necessarily the grand plaza or, you know, the great boulevards and those kind of things, but the simple sidewalk. And you know, that's where I named my book as I did. Sidewalks are an incredibly important aspect of public space. And Jane Jacobs, very sad to hear that she had died yesterday, because she's been my inspiration in terms of paying attention to sidewalks. And in her book, Death and Life of Great American Cities, she articulates three different uses of sidewalks. Sidewalks are for human contact, sidewalks are for the purpose of assimilating children, and sidewalks are for protection. She says, in most urban neighborhoods, it's not the police that provides protection, it's the eyes on the street. When you have some street activity going on and you've arranged your houses or apartment buildings so people can look out the window and enjoy watching that, that's much better protection than with police. So sidewalks are a very important aspect of public space. Subset of public space is the third place. Very important for community life. This is from Ray Oldenburg, who says that most of us have a first place, our home, and then some of us have a second place, we go to work, but we need a third place between those, like a coffee shop, like a barber shop, like a whatever, a bench, a certain collection of benches in warm climates. A place where you can go, you don't have to be there, but you can go there and just hang out. It's got a real informal kind of feel, and there's maybe some regulars that hang out there. And the great thing about a third place, and why it's so important for community development, is he says, before you're going to invite somebody over to your house for dinner, just because of the social risk involved on both sides, there's an elaborate screening mechanism that goes on. Is this someone that I can, you know, would want in my house? And they're thinking, is this someone that I would want to go to their house? And, you know, for me it means cleaning up our house and getting ready for a guest to come over for dinner. And consequently, we think we should invite people over for dinner, new people in the area or people we don't know very well, and we don't do it as often as we think we should. Those that we do know fairly well, we just don't do it very often. Oldenburg says, when you have a third place, it allows you to form friendships with people you wouldn't invite over for dinner. And maybe those friendships can develop into the kind of intimacy, even though they're very different from you, you might get to a point of inviting them into your home. But it's a great starting place for human relationships. Okay, let's see. The next marker of the city is beauty. I think buildings tell a story. We've been talking about vernacular architecture, and you know, a lot of good vernacular architecture tells you a kind of a local story about the materials that are available. There's a typological story in a lot of historic buildings. Oh, that's a church. That's a bank. That's a Buddhist temple. You know, that there's a typology that we can appeal to hear these stories. And I think a lot of our post-war architecture in this country doesn't adequately tell a story. And so it's not beautiful on that level. The suburbs are also, well, let's see, yeah, turn this thing here. That's the courthouse, the county courthouse in Malibu, California. It's a very wealthy community, and that's their public space. I mean, we just don't spend, not only does the public realm not get any sort of spatial priority, it doesn't get any financial priority anymore. And so our courthouses look extremely ugly. I challenge anybody to find me a courthouse built since 1950 that looks anything as nice as a courthouse built prior to that time. I mean, we're just not investing in beauty anymore. The suburbs are ugly in some ways because the buildings don't tell a story, because the public realm hasn't been built very beautifully, and because oftentimes the buildings are all of a certain pattern that don't have any individual character. Okay, and you won't have an image for this one, but I was just going to say that you can go to even very modest neighborhoods built prior to World War II, and oftentimes they're very beautiful, just because of the individual touch that people have put on them. turn the slide to the next one. Here's a picture of the Pasadena City Hall, and it's doing something. Not only is it a beautiful building built in the 20s, but it's also doing something that you rarely see anymore. It's terminating the vista on Holly Avenue, and it was part of a Beaux Arts plan, and a couple of buildings did this kind of move. As you walk down the street, you see this grand building terminating the vista, and it's sort of putting a grand building in that place in the city kind of tells you that in some ways our collective public good is more important than my individual needs this time. It kind of orders your life a little bit. But we don't terminate vistas anymore because engineers hate it, because it's sort of it's hard for cars to navigate, you know, the right turns they have to make to get around that building. Who can tell me where there are two examples of a terminated vista in America built between say, anywhere post-war to 1985. Can anyone guess? There's only two examples that I can think of. I wonder if Lewis knows. Terminated vistas in America from 1945 to
1985.
Disney World's the easy
answer. Cinderella's Castle or whatever that is. It's going on Main Street. What's that?
Some stadium?
No.
It was built in that time period? Like,
yeah, somewhere. Well, Disneyland's the other one. So anyway. I mean, it's funny that in America we built, you know, these theme parks with Main Street USA, with streets that come right up to the sidewalk and terminated vistas and all these things that, and then we escape to these places and we can't figure out why we're so miserable in our homes, you know, as if we'd forgotten how to do that kind of thing. Okay. So, now, if you ask anybody, why can't we build something beautiful like the Pasadena City Hall anymore? What they'll say is, we can't afford it anymore. And I think that's a cop-out. I mean, there may be situations where we can't afford it anymore, but I don't buy that in a lot of cases. We've got more financial resources than we did in the 1920s. A more accurate way to say it doesn't solve the problem, but I think we can at least ask people to be honest, is we can say we don't value it anymore. We still have the money, we just don't value it anymore. Beauty is not as important to us. Let me see what my next, oh, turn the pages. It's kind of old, cheap shot, but anyway. Michael Jordan. We value superstars. We pay them a lot of money. We value a lot of things. We don't value beauty as much anymore. And I don't know if we can solve that right now, but I do think that churches can be one place where we can begin to make that cultural shift. And until we do make that cultural shift, I think one of the places where we still have beautiful buildings are a lot of our cities and traditional neighborhoods. And we ought to be on the forefront of helping to honor those places and highlight those. All right. Local economy is important. This is a picture. Do you get a picture of this one? Mm-hmm. All right, this is a picture of my family. We're in McLeod, California. It's a wonderful little small town that has good urbanity in a sense, in that it's got a nice little dense central core for its scale, and it's got a hotel there, it's got a couple of churches, got modest houses and shopping all down there. The problem is there's no money there anymore because it was a logging town, and money dried up. And so, you know, this nice high school that was built in the 80s, probably for 1,500 students, had I think a dozen students enrolled when we were there. You know, economy makes a difference. And, you know, in a way, I don't want to push this too far, but we need to be careful to be against anything commercial, in a sense, like those developers. Or, I mean, they're bad developers. I'm not saying that's not true. But it's a complicated world as to how to make an economy work and how to work with an economy to do the kinds of things that we want to do. And I think we ought to be willing to work in this way. I was just talking with a guy on Monday. Or we were talking, this guy gave a great lecture on beautiful architecture and why we ought to be in favor of beautiful architecture and how it can be done. And you know, at the end I said, that's wonderful, but I've got a friend who's a kind of a developer in Missoula, and he hears this kind of stuff and he's convicted. So he wants to do a beautiful building in Missoula, kind of as a gift to the community. And he finds an architect that's willing to design a beautiful building. And that's all systems go. And he wants to do it. Guess what the problem is? Getting the loan. Bank's not going to loan money for that kind of building because the building has to begin to pay for itself within 3 years. They don't have a financial structure in place to pay for that kind of beauty. And so, you know, consequently, buildings that pay for themselves in 3 years oftentimes are disposable buildings that are built to last 30 or 40 years. So, I mean, all I'm saying in this is the economy is part of what we have to work with. And we do need, I think, Christians who can do, there's a term that I love, the financial architecture to make it work. You know, okay, let's put some parking spaces here. We can rent those parking spaces so that we can do the low-income housing. And then let's, you know, you got to put the pieces together sometimes to make it work. So a vibrant economy can make it happen. All right, the next picture it was going to be the counter of McLeod, California. I had a picture of Seattle there. You know, a lot of people think the city is a bad place for families and we should go to, you know, small towns are a great place to raise our kids. The problem is you pick a town like McLeod to raise your kids, and when they grow up, they leave, you know, because they can't find jobs. And so at least, you know, why I think that cities are very family friendly is oftentimes they've got the kind of economy that can, your kids can get jobs and you can have some intergenerational stuff going on. Problem is, when you get to a city with a vibrant economy, housing prices go up, makes it hard to live there. And the neighborhoods where it is affordable to live, and we've already gotten onto this, oftentimes don't have very good schools. So again, it's a complicated thing, but I think it's the kind of work that we can be doing as Christians to improve the built environment. All right, the fifth marker is critical mass. The logic of suburbia is all about space. You buy as much space as you can afford. The big, you know, everyone talks about square footage, and we have, you know, if you compare 1950 to 1990 or 2000, we've gone way up in square footage and way down in family size. We just need as much space as we can get so our kids don't, you know, have to decide which TV to watch. They can all watch in their own room. You also put your house on the largest lot, so you don't have to work out things with your neighbor. You just put space between yourself and your neighbor. That's the basic logic. Problem is, there's a lot of problems with that logic. One is there's a civic problem. We don't interact with each other. There's an environmental problem. It's one of the most inefficient ways to organize ourselves, to put that much space between ourselves and our neighbors. You have to, for all those 5-acre houses that aren't producing anything on the land, you got to get sewage out there. You got to get services out there. It's impossible to do public transportation at that low of a density. It's almost impossible to have a really efficient system. It's all tied together when you get the density wrong. The reason, well, I'm saying density here, but the reason why I generally don't say density is because anytime you say density, you get homeowners associations all up your back saying, we don't want density, that's bad. I'd like to propose that density is one of the most wonderful things about a city, and the places with the most density are the most fun places to be. So, anyway, well, there's another picture of a lonely parking lot there. That's what space looks like when you go to get some groceries or something like that. You don't run into anybody. You don't have these funny encounters with people that, you know, share your interests or not. All right, so critical mass is the third slide there. Critical mass is really one of the great things that a city can offer to a population. I'm not going to try to convince this crowd of that. You guys all know that. The sixth marker of the city then, and this one is particularly, I think, important for a Christian audience, and that is the presence of strangers. We've already talked about the fact that you can live in the private realm within the suburbs, and you can say to yourself, I believe, you know, in showing hospitality to the stranger, and I'm going to show hospitality to the next stranger that I see. But you've made a fundamental moral decision that you're never going to see a stranger. So that's sort of the problem. But strangers, if that's really part of our Christian mandate to care for the stranger, that has something to say about how we arrange our living environments. The problem with the suburbs is there's no place for the stranger. The land's either, you know, everyone's got their 5-acre parcel, and unlike Britain, you can't just walk through it to go on your walk. You know, that's their land, and they can shoot you if you cross that fence. Oftentimes, the soft-sided, grassy slope that runs right to the street, no sidewalk, no sign. It's all sort of understood. If you don't know, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones and can park on their parking strip, you don't belong here. There's oftentimes no public realm, no public bench to sit down. So there's really literally no place for a stranger to kind of find a way to just kind of hang out in the suburbs. In a small town, the other end of the scale, you know, people literally do all know each other. And so strangers oftentimes feel a little weird, or they're ostracized for not knowing anyone. So consequently, the city is one of the last places, let me go to the next slide, where we're likely to find a stranger. And that's why a lot of, you know, folks who are drifting or homeless or you know, trying to get away from their family or whatever, or, you know, Heidi's example of the gay teens, you know, that's why they come to places like cities, because people don't hassle them there. They can sort of sit on the bench for a while. No one's going to know they don't belong there. So that's where the strangers are. That's where we ought to be as Christians as well. So anyway, that's the sixth marker. Let me just try to give this one kind of application by way of Christian ministry, or give you some focus. It's not the only way that I think this applies to the Christian faith. I think there's there's a number of ways to spin this off, but in Sidewalks, I try to retell a biblical story in a suburban context. I do that a couple of times just to bring this to light. In this particular case, I'm thinking about the story of the hemorrhaging woman. You know, Jesus is on the way to heal Jairus' daughter, and he hears that, or Jairus sends an appeal to come heal his daughter. And Jairus is a rich, important person, you know, he's the kind of guy that's going to send for help when his daughter gets sick to this important person, Jesus. And Jesus is on the way to heal Jairus' daughter, and a hemorrhaging woman who's been in a lot of pain for a long time and probably doesn't feel a lot of access to the resources in the community touches the hem of Jesus' garment. They have an exchange. She's healed. Her life has changed forever. Jesus is late showing up to Jairus' house, you know, still does the greater miracle there, but, you know, all is good. And it's a wonderful story. It's supposed to teach us something about the way we do ministry. You know, that we should be interruptible, that we should be ready to be discerning of the Spirit when somebody comes that we didn't expect, that we should be willing to help out somebody who doesn't have the self-confidence to make an appointment with us. You know, all these kinds of stories, I find it almost impossible to appropriate that story in a suburban context. And I don't really get too descriptive here, but let me remember what I said. Jesus is in a private home in a subdivision where he gets a call from an elder of the megachurch 12 miles away whose daughter is sick. He and his disciples hop into their Suburban and drive 20 miles across town to another subdivision and heal the elder's daughter. The other parts of town they encounter at 40 miles per hour through shadow-proof glass. The hemorrhaging woman is in one of those other parts of town, perhaps in a seedy motel, alone in her pain and convinced that she's not important enough for someone like Jesus. So, you know, if we take that story into post-war suburbia, it's really hard to figure out what are we going to do with it. How are we supposed to be interruptible at 40 miles an hour behind glass in that sense? And, you know, as Americans, there's a couple ways we might go about solving that. You know, let's invent a radar that we put on top of our Chevy Suburban, the Technofix, that's going to notice pain and it's going to beep. And then we can pull over and, you know, do the healing thing or whatever. We're going to help her out somehow. Or we could do the programmatic solution. Let's figure out, let's divide the city into regions and let's, you know, put some subdeacon on each of those regions and we'll, you know, just kind of organize ourselves out of that problem. And that may work. It just seems a little modernist to me and a little complicated. I guess the way I understand my piece of this whole puzzle, and this word might confuse you if you go to the next slide. It confused a guy on Monday when I was trying to formulate it. I call it pre-incarnational ministry. And by that I don't mean, you know, let's think about that time before the incarnation happened. I grew up in a culture, sort of an evangelical culture, where we talked about incarnational ministry, you know, where you instead of doing a lot of programs or expecting people to come to you, you came to them and developed a relationship, a human-to-human relationship. And I think that I really affirm that model of ministry. I like that model of ministry. I think it's real hard to do that kind of ministry when we're driving everywhere, when we don't have times for sort of natural human contact. I call it pre-incarnational ministry in that I want to see the built environment changed in such a way that we do bump into each other. I think that's a much better way of getting at that problem, you know, than trying to make a technological fix for why we can't see the hemorrhaging woman. So I know it's not the only piece of the puzzle. I know it might take some time to make that cultural shift, that maybe it's better if we get back to communities where you can walk around and run into each other. Maybe it's time to get back to a model of church, a more of a parish model. We care not just for what's happening within the church, but care for the geography around the church. That might take some time. And so I think there's a lot of good stopgap ministries in the meantime. I think there probably are ways to, you know, use the car to do incarnational ministry and ways to get around the barriers that it presents. All I'm saying is it's a worthwhile investment of our time to start rethinking our use of the built environment so that we can do incarnational ministry. So that's all I'll say for now. We've got maybe a few minutes for questions.
Fake things on the window, that's a part of the car suburban culture. market-driven economy is a moral issue. Mm-hmm. As long as we say market determines, then we say people determine less. Mm-hmm. And that is in, that is inherently going to structure the way the rest of these things fall out.
Right. Right. So yeah, no, I agree. That's, it's, there's a lot of corrective that we can be working on along the way, and I think we do need to call those things out, because I do think there's a moral imperative there. But you know, part of my, you know, we all come with a complicated mix. I come from a family of entrepreneurs that are in business, and from two generations. And the weird strain in that is, my father didn't go that direction, went into the ministry. So we were always the poor family surrounded by rich people. And then I'm repeating the pattern. Now my mom started a business, all my brother and sister in the corporate world, and I went into the ministry, and now my family's in power. I mean, it's this great little pattern, but and it's really wonderful in the sense that I kind of have to face these folks at the dinner table, and I have a hard time just saying, you're evil because you're in the corporate world. You know what I mean? That's just, and that's, I know that we need people who can say that maybe more aggressively than I do, but I also think, you know, I look at the decisions they make. My grandfather, after years of struggle, opened, you know, closed a factory in the U.S. And opened overseas. He knew the stories of every one of those people, and it killed him to do that. But I understand the difficulty that, you know, he's facing financial problems. Do I close? Do I go bankrupt? Or do I do this? So I guess I've just been given that one little insight to say, you know, these folks are making moral steps one at a time, just like junior high kids are making more, you know, whether it's sexual, whatever we're at.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a matter of degree thing, too. Yeah. I mean, I hear you, absolutely, and have those relationships with people that sit at church or whatever, but, you know, it seems to me, I'm not an economist, but it just seems like we're going in a direction where, I'm not saying the market isn't important, but it seems like we're going in a direction that's, or has gone in a direction where it's extreme to the degree to which you're saying, or assuming, you know, the market drives. And just to keep that piece of it, although it brings some balance to it.
Right, no, I agree. And I think there's a way to even say it in a way that sounds like good news to somebody that's embroiled in it. You know what I mean? It's not just you're bad, but can't we see a better way? You know, what if you, with developers especially, there's a great line that, you know, these developers, one thing that drives some of the better ones is this. They would say, my grandfather was a developer of this town. He's a hero. Developers today are the scum of the earth. This person left a legacy. These are the ones that are saying, I want to do it different. So there's some that recognize the market sometimes leads us down blind paths. And if you can speak that kind of message to developers, why don't you leave a legacy? Instead of just making that extra $100 million or whatever, why don't you leave a legacy? And I've got the perfect project. You know, another, you know, Bill Gates once said, as arrogant as ever, but you know, it's easier to make $1 billion and give away $1 billion. Sometimes they're so out of touch with what's really happening. They don't, you know what I mean? I don't want to embroil them that, but.
Just a question that connects with the story of your grandfather that I've written. It's a question about double alienation. What happens when the broken pizza model you began your presentation with combines with the globalization dynamic, where not only are we separated from our community, we're now separate within the world, and we don't even know who makes.
Right.
We don't know who we live with. We don't know who makes the things we.
Oh, I know.
We own and wear.
I think it's deeply distressing, and I think, you know, I think fuel prices eventually. I don't know. That's not my expertise. I'm hoping that. And I kind of cheer when gas prices go up in some respects.
So. Why? What do you hope for?
Well, I think it's all driven by transportation issues. I mean, the reason we can get our toilet seats in China is because it's cheap enough to do so. It makes sense at some bizarre financial logic. And so, you know, once those numbers shift, I think the local gets some. I mean, I think there's complex issues there. There are certain things that I want to be globalized. You know, I want my grandma's pacemaker to be globalized in a sense. I want it to be as well done as possible. But I want furniture locally made. I want food locally grown. You know what I mean? Like, even there, I think we have to show some wisdom in terms of thinking, what are we really asking for, and how do we get it? So, anyway.
Thank you so very much.
Yeah.